Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Hey, everybody. It's another episode of This Life. Bob, welcome.
Here we are.
And we have a special guest. We have a couple special guests today. We're starting off with Fred Stoller.
Hey.
Fred.
I came here to your nice house, not sure what I'm supposed to do.
Well, you're going to just ask us questions. You're going to engage in good conversation.
Great.
And you're going to be the naive addict professional trying to find out where your friend should go.
All right.
We have Anna David coming a little bit later. And Bob, anything on your mind before we get into Fred's?
Well, I went to Charlotte, North Carolina, and went to the Dilworth Center in Charlotte. The most amazing people, the most amazing place for young people, and just, you would have loved it. Just treatment like how it used to be.
Right. I'm gaining faith. I've talked to a couple other programs, and I've spoken to the professionals there and felt like I'd met long-lost relatives or something. It was the weirdest thing.
They know what I'm talking about.
I really felt like I've been in jail or something, and somebody let me out. You know, it's like, oh my God, you're free. We're here. We're okay. And the language is the same.
Yeah.
The priorities are the same. The great outcomes are there.
Well, it was all a given. It's just the most excellent people, doctors of psychology running groups and just like high quality.
Yeah.
And the real discussion was at lunch and at dinner, and I was there for 3 days and I spoke at their event or whatever, was what to do about these kids. And that's the thing, is rather than the Los Angeles atypical thing, is how to exploit them financially, because they're never going to get a job. They're never going to be sober.
The virus that is treatment.
That maybe we're perverted by living in L.A.
Maybe it's better elsewhere.
Yeah, because anyways. But the idea is that they were having categories of surrendered and unsurrendered addicts, which is the contemplative stage.
Right.
I was talking about that.
Differently in different categories?
Yeah, they need different treatment plans.
Yeah, right.
Wow, imagine rather than just a cookie cut for everybody.
Just put them on Suboxone, they'll be fine. Come on now.
They're going to go to Stanford as soon as we finish billing for them.
Oh, my God. So
that's a Los Angeles treatment. So it was really refreshing to be around all these cool people. And then I went to the Charlotte Hornets game, and they won.
And to be fair, that's the kind of program we ran for a long time.
For years, and we were put out of business by Malibu. You think we were put out of business by I don't know what. I knew years before we were going to get put out of business.
But I'm sorry to interrupt. This is my first time listening to your podcast, so it's very much about, obviously,
treatment,
well, celebrity.
Listen, we want to be about life and philosophy and all kinds of things, but we drift into this when it's on our mind.
Okay, so you guys did what you did on Celebrity Rehab before the thing. You knew each other
for years.
From running treatment.
For years. Yeah. We ran a hospital-based program that I would tell everybody, I said, look, the sickest, the patients that everybody else was done with, we can handle. The incorrigible, the medically ill, the psychotic, the severe psychiatrically impaired, we got them.
Because if you know how to deal with them, you know what to do.
And we had wonderful outcomes, fantastic outcomes.
Well, see, I'm just some jerk who would read about things in the newspaper and go, this guy will never get treatment, when you see those True Hollywood specials. So you never,
Fred, funny you would say
gave
that.
Up on anyone.
Well, not only that. No, we would kick people out quite routinely. That's how we got our reputation. We were tough. If somebody was willing to work with us, we got them. If they gave us shit and destroyed the program or infected other people with their bullshit, we were very. We'd send them other good places.
So you never had a guy come in and go to Bob, I don't know, this is hopeless.
Oh, pretty much most of the cases.
Okay,
not only the patients, but the doctors would feel that way. We had a lot of that. And I want to say, we had one thing. If you didn't need other than a ventilator, like you needed to be on a breathing machine, we got it. We can take care of it. Seizing.
And we had different levels of care and psychiatric care, so we could move people to get the care they needed, then come back and face their issues with us.
We had aftercare.
And that,
rich 12-step community.
That doesn't exist anymore.
But your point about never giving up is what created Celebrity Rehab was what, Bob?
Well, I just was sick of how Lindsay Lohan and Britney Spears were getting treated in the media, and how everybody thought they were hopeless. This is before they even got treatment, I think. What it was...
Right, they're being treated as just, they're so goofy, they're trying to get attention. Remember that?
And there was a real negative
attitude. Or that they'd, like Robert Downey would go and Charlie Sheen and just have just work out and have fun.
Right.
Yeah, that's what became the norm. But this is even before that, where these people, because they have so much, they shouldn't be on drugs and all this kind of negative, uninformed attitude.
We didn't prefer, but we did treat a lot of celebrities because we had a good reputation. And also reputation for keeping it very confidential. We treated a lot of people you never heard about.
Right.
And they were sick. They were really, really sick. And we got tired of the press saying that they were on a vacation or a spa treatment.
Well, let me ask you. Drew was on, I do a podcast once in a while. And there were two questions I forgot to ask.
Okay.
One of them, you know, just being an outsider watching your show, was because it's TV, obviously they want drama and conflict. Now, when someone goes to a rehab, and obviously they're paying a lot of money, did they really fight with each other?
Like crazy.
Oh, yeah.
I told them, for sure. I thought that was amped up for the
VH1. No, I told the producers that they wanted to monkey with people. I threw fits. I kept going, these are patients. They are ill. Stay the fuck away from them. And don't worry about the conflict.
Just keep the cameras rolling.
There's always shit going down on a drug unit.
As an outsider, I would think, if you're paying, and I don't know what they cost, but I heard like $30,000 for a treatment, why would you be spending your time fighting?
Well, here's the thing that was a real mistake in the public's interpretation of celebrity rehab.
Let me explain. Answer why they fight when they're in their treatment.
Because if they're sober and they're fucking miserable.
Right.
And they have to externalize that misery onto other people.
To point it and project at other
people.
Blame.
But one of the things, it's not just a celebrity thing with them going at each other.
But there was a thought that was all false and those people were acting. Let me tell you something. Most of those people went on that show to rehabilitate their image. So they were trying extra hard not to act out and not to be an asshole.
Right.
And they were still completely out of control crazy. So imagine how irritable, restless, and discontented they feel being off their drugs of choice.
Okay, you know, the thing, I'm being ridiculous because the whole thing is nothing rational works. I'm asking something rational like, hey, I'm paying so much money, I don't want to waste it fighting. But the whole idea that junkies, it's not rational. I used to follow the NBA and go, they're drug testing this guy and he'll lose millions.
Roy Tarpley.
Yes, yeah, so he was the first.
First guy that lost $100 million contract.
And there have been a few others. And we can't judge because I learned when I had a depression, I told Drew, that rational thought goes out the window. When someone is suicidal, you can go, oh, you have four kids. Rational thought
isn't
out the window. So I learned not to judge.
For everybody, I'm going to locate Fred in culture. Fred was on Everyone Loves Raymond all the time. You recognize his voice, no doubt. You know him from television?
Yeah.
Just Dumb and Dumber, just some guest spot stuff.
Yeah.
And
wrote a book called
Maybe We'll Have You Back, The Life of a Perennial TV Guest
Star.
That's what I was at the West Hollywood thing with my book. I saw Bob. There was like a book little Fair. Festival thing. Yeah. It was
hotter than shit.
Oh,
it was like 110 degrees.
I
it was so miserable.
Okay, my other question about rehab I forgot to ask is, now let's say someone talks me into going to rehab. Now, what's their incentive? Because I know rationally, or they know, your first one usually doesn't stick. You need four. So what's their incentive
to go
to really think it's going to help it?
No, the actual statistics are a third of the time it works right away.
Okay.
Right? A third is an old study that was made by NIDA, the National Institute of Drug and Alcohol.
I thought it was worse than that.
No, a third. Doesn't mean they'll remain abstinent, but they won't return to treatment, and somehow the ideas make sense to them, and they eventually will make them make sense. There's a second third, like me, that went to 24 places and just fighting yourself and everybody around you. But somehow in that fight and that continual perseverance and tenacity means that the things make sense to you. You just have to work it out. You want to get well. And a third of the people don't ever want to get well. And I think that third is growing because of pain management, because of Suboxone.
But what I'm trying to say is when someone does an intervention, they may think, well, I've heard so many stories that this one won't be the one.
Well, I've always said it. If people followed our directions, it would be the one. If they stayed in long enough, they followed our direction, it would be the one. Most people they want to go back work, they have exceptions, they have this, they have that, and they fight their way out. And that's usually why it doesn't work more than anything. And that's the disease as much as anything that makes them think that way. But as far as what motivates them, usually the first treatments, relationships, family, friends, coworkers, wives, that kind of thing, financial problems, like, or legal problems, and the courts. That's usually what brings them in, would you say? Or medical problems.
The sad thing
is
the courts you can take out of it now because they're not prosecuting anything.
Great. So Fred, so they're coming in motivated externally. It's sort of, they're
so
like...
what makes them really do it the time? Not just an NBA contract or drug testing.
What makes them get...
What makes them finally
two things. Two things.
Collect.
A profound belief that they're going to die if they don't.
Okay.
In their toes. They have to believe that. Every inch of their being has to believe that.
And they have to not want to die.
Yes, that's right. They have to
so
not want to
die.
It's
not about keeping a relationship or a job.
None of that, Matt. All those priorities go away the big priorities use. But we're talking about sick addicts. I was reminded again, Bobby, that I took care of sick.
It's
a continuum. There are people who are not as bad as the people we routinely took care of. But often people get there.
I'll give a personal example so you can understand. So first time a girl told me, I'm going to move out unless you stop taking drugs, I said, let's get a moving van. When my freedom started getting taken away from me.
And for men losing freedom, that gets in there. But what those things create is changes direction, is people suddenly, it kind of sinks in. Like they see themselves as they are, as your freedom, those kind of thing. The other is... And
look on your mom's face sometimes.
Well, and I've found that if you start letting other humans in a real way, right, it gets harder. You start making contact with, you start seeing yourself more clearly because you're allowing for an interpersonal thing to develop.
Most of the people who listen to this have loved ones that are usually their children, right? They like being a part of the group, even though they might complain. As soon as they leave, they relapse.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing about treatment. As soon as you're doing well, you should leave because this costs money.
Let me frame the conversation. All chemicals have some potential therapeutic value. These are just chemicals and they affect the brain. Duncan will argue that it helps you take the elevator up to some enlightenment and then you take the elevator back down again. It shows you something that you can get
to. Yes, and it stays with you when you're straight.
But he thinks you can get to that then by other means like meditation and so once you've seen it. So there's work for you to do there that's non-pharmacological. The pharmacological always has a cost. There's nothing in nature is for free. The cost is typically anxiety, depression, motivational problems, that kind of stuff, or psychoses, or medical problems from depending on what the drug is you're using. But heroin has a therapeutic value, right? Alcohol was used for years as a therapeutic product. But these things all come with a cost. And so that's the question. Is the cost worth the potential benefit? And how much can you really predict a real potential benefit from some of these things? They're not going to be able to stand up to real scrutiny.
What about once every few weeks?
But an extreme, let's say somebody as a veteran and has untreatable post-traumatic stress disorder. These extreme situations, of course, you try stuff. You try because it's just so awful. There's nothing. We don't have other things.
Well, Drew, answering your question.
But common white people problems, I just don't follow. you just got common white people problems.
Well, answering my question and yours. No, look, I'm really learning a lot about black history and life. I thought, and Drew said something I disagree with. He said after the Civil War, there was Shangri-La, blacks and whites. No.
Yeah, for a brief time.
No, I never heard that. I'm learning history.
No, well, you're talking about the Reconstruction, which was horrible. That was awful.
I thought that when the slaves were emancipated, there was segregation, which is bad.
Yes.
But I didn't know, I didn't know slavery continued in Alabama until 1945.
Terrible stuff.
That it was, they would just say, you're a vagrant. And own them, and they're still with slavery. So I feel I've emancipated myself. I feel like I'm the white guy, the black guy inside me.
Yeah, from mental slavery.
Yes. Yeah, so no. I know we're privileged being white. I take nothing for granted. I'm reading all these current
books.
No,
but it's a Louis C.K. joke, and it is that all these problems. 90% of the shit I hear is is to be depressed. Okay, I get it. It's a depressing society. We should do something about
this
society.
But it's chemical. It's not. No, I learned that when some...
I'm just looking across.
I learned... when I went through this depression, I went through recently. Again, you're being rational thought-based. What was getting to me was my mind lying to me and amplifying it that, I'm unwanted, it's all measurable. So no, I know rationally when my mind's not working right, yes, I'm lucky that, I don't have a cubicle suffocating job.
And I'm not trying to say there's people starving in China and you should finish your meal. I'm saying that we've become such a neurotic, self-involved society that if we just switch things around, which is more of like Gloria Scott's way,
but sometimes
if you went
need...
down to Watts and tried to help some kids learn how to read, you wouldn't right. be so fucking depressed.
But but sometimes there's chemicals.
Yeah, yeah. He had real bona fide depression.
No, I understand. But, yeah. but in that paralyzation with chemical depression is an inactivity that only leads to
right.
more deeper depression.
I agree with that. I had a paralyzing depression. I needed to get on some other medicine that's really helping, but you can't just say to someone, do volunteer
work, or go
to the gym. You know all this
Bob,
rationally.
It's a little bit like you back in the day going into the ICU in the psych ward.
And I'm doing really well now.
I don't know your case, and I'm not talking about your case. I'm talking about in general,
yes.
in America, there's a tremendous amount of anxiety and depression and personality disorders that in a society that says we're so loving and so kind and
right.
so Christian and so wonderful, when we have children starving,
oh,
when
please.
We have children who don't know how to read and nobody's doing anything about it,
and,
they want the government to do it.
And we are right that families need to do it again. Communities need to do it again. And
we all
are,
need to do
and
it.
And by the way, we are intolerant. Freud's whole project was to not... When he came to the United States, they asked him, what's your plan here? What are you trying to treat? And he goes, well, I'm interested in people with not ordinary misery. Yeah. Anything other than ordinary misery, I'm interested in. And you know what I mean? Ordinary misery is what life is. There's ordinary misery, and then there's illness. And you had an illness, and I'm going to defend Fred on this one.
But
there's a philosophical question he added. That's what I'm going to get at a little bit, which is he asks a question about what's real. Because he felt differently in this altered state. And he was asking, well, why isn't that what's real when I can see all these things, right? Isn't that your question?
Yes. Why is the physical world the real world? Why is that not real when you're just, you know...
The real world...
I know, crossing streets and paying rent.
No, but not to get too existential. But the real world is what's going on in your brain. That's the real world.
Yeah. So if it's this... All I know is summing up... No. First of all, yeah, it's... Answering my question about the honest thing that I told myself is that I said, Fred, if my life was, you know, again, I'm not complaining, but I'm just saying where I've had interactions and creative stuff to sink my teeth into, I wouldn't be trying to knock out the night with an editor.
And I would argue, I totally agree, Fred, that I think that's where the rubber hits the road.
So I didn't realize that.
And I think that it was an escape to a different place that was meaningful, but it was still an escape. And you are much better. And you are much better when you are engaged.
Exactly.
And when you, if you, and you're, for you, engagement is a creative process.
Yes.
And you need to find that again. You need to get
I'm getting it again. Right. Like I'm happiest, Bob, when I have something creative to sink my teeth into.
I know that.
Like,
about
I love.
But I think, you know, there's a fellow named James Masterson that was one of the original self psychologists. And he, the conclusion of all his work was something he called the creative solution. He really believes that, you know, I believe a lot of it's interpersonal, but ultimately it's about creating, not just in the world, but in here, in yourself,
yeah.
You know, what you create and how you build and grow.
When you go volunteer with children, you go down to the mission, volunteer one day a month, you learn empathy and compassion.
I'm not sure, Bob.
You do.
Yeah,
People do. I know thousands of volunteers in Los Angeles. I rarely hear them say, I'm so depressed,
I would never discourage anybody from doing it because it does give you perspective. It does make you gratitude, if anything else.
Yes,
and
whatever words you want
to
put.
But I used to put a lot more faith in that creating empathy, and then I started realizing that people really, that's a slower... taller order.
Well, whatever you want to call it, the good words.
Yeah.
The good words get created in helping less fortunate people. The bad words, depression, suicide, misery, the anger, frustration, terrorism. This all gets created by a lot of self-involvement.
I'm not defending myself. I'm just saying in general, there's a difference between someone whining and someone going, I know I have it great, but my mind's not right.
Yeah, yeah.
So go to a psychiatrist and get some meds.
Well, that's what happened. So,
yeah, that's
when he's better.
That's what I'm saying.
But in that process, he
But everybody
he
knows that. You don't get every pass.
No, everybody knows that. No. On the contrary,
there are people that have depression and they believe the thoughts. They believe their mind is right. You know what I'm saying?
Not only that, there are plenty of people with not what Fred had that go to psychiatrists shouldn't bother. You know what I'm saying? This is the real deal. Then this poor guy gets treatment.
When 70% of Americans are on some sort of psychiatric meds for sleep or for personality problems, you can bet that most people know if you're feeling like killing yourself, go to a psychiatrist.
I'm happy I'm not on a cocktail. All right.
Fred Stoller.
All right.
We're going to take a break.
Segment.
That's Fred's
segment. There
you
go.
All right, we're back with this live, Bob.
Here we are.
And we are joined by Anna David.
Hi.
Hey now.
Here we are.
So Anna is somebody, she wrote the best recovery book I'd ever read. And I mean, that's a pretty tall order.
He's read a lot of them.
I know.
Yeah, it was so right and so honest and so from the right perspective and with the right everything, all the right stuff was there. Just the way, like when we go to a treatment center, we're like, oh my God, thank God they're thinking this way. They're offering that was what I felt when I read your book.
With completely narcissistic protagonist, which was an accurate depiction of alcoholism.
Absolutely.
No, she was hated, that protagonist.
You were good in your disease and you were described as good out.
Well, thank you. You know how much that means to me. And the reason I did a novel and not a memoir is that, with all due respect, I do think a lot of the memoirs about addiction get incredibly boring once the person gets sober.
Not only that, I'm certainly it was inspired by reality, I could tell.
Right, definitely.
And you don't want to out people, you know, you'd have to edit stories that were important. You probably couldn't even tell if the real people were involved, you know what I mean? You'd have to get their permission or whatever. This you could just have at it with your rhetorical flair.
I didn't think back then, this was my first book, so I didn't think about how people were going to respond, the people in my life were going to respond to these things. I was just completely ignorant, and I had one person who took the fictional version of her and really, you know, sort of felt hurt and betrayed.
She saw herself
and all
in
of
it.
These things. Yeah.
How did you respond to that?
I was really surprised because
What did you say to her?
That's a good question. It all happened over email. We actually, you know, weren't really in active friendship.
Wasn't
anymore.
Real human contact.
Certainly aren't in active friendship any longer either. No,
but it was. I've learned a lot since then about showing people pages ahead of time. And really understanding that it's not all about me, you know.
I think that the way you do that is go, look, that was not you, but you did inspire me, and here's how I'm experiencing. You know.
I wrote a book about my life and my friends, and a couple of them were upset, and it's their problem. My life, too.
Oh, boy.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, but maybe it's because I have a license. I can't do that. You know?
Yeah, doctors can't do it. You did cracked.
Yeah. But that was all fictionalized stuff, too.
That's Sasha for sure.
Oh, you guys were there. No, I told you
guys. I wasn't there. Sasha was.
You weren't in it?
I wasn't in it. It was before I worked there.
Oh, is that
right?
Yeah,
yeah. But Sasha's in it. Anyways, Drew did what you
did.
Well,
so was Dr. Freeman. But I told them both they were going to be in it. I told them. That they were inspired the character.
I told everyone.
And what's weird? You know what's weird? Wait. I got to some very spooky weird. After I put it out, Sasha read it and she was moved and liked it and stuff. And she goes, "Do you know my family calls me Alexi?" Which was the name I made up for that character.
Oh, really?
Oh my God!
How crazy is that?
Well, there are things that we know that we don't know. Yeah, we got to make this the
Susan loves that
right now. Yeah,
it's so weird. It's not a name I normally like.
That was the ghost telling you.
But it came to me, and it was like, that's the name I want to use for this character. That's like Sasha.
Yeah. What is this? This was a novel you did.
Yeah, called Cracked.
Yeah,
about rehab.
Oh, you wrote? Is that the one you?
It was the first book about rehab.
Yes.
Oh yeah, I did read that a long time
ago. That was the first book about rehab.
That was a lot. What that came out in the '90s, yeah.
2000. It was. All I know is it was about a year after 9/11 because I developed a writer's block for months after 9/11. It was the weirdest thing. I just couldn't write. It was crazy. Because it was very crazy. I mean, it was fictional, you know. So I had to create all this stuff, and it was obviously inspired by experiences and things. But I had to make sure that it wasn't really embedded in the experiences and stuff, and unless it was just mine, you know, not anybody else's. And I just couldn't write anymore during 9/11. It was the weirdest thing.
But why is it that whole memoir thing? If you go back to James Frey, and I wrote a book, and everyone I know has written a book. There's actually situations that happen in my life where there are four book accounts of it you can read,
and they're all different. Right.
And they're all different.
Well, I wrote one of them. What I don't know if you remember, I interviewed you for the Sizemore book.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
you are very prominently featured in that book.
There's one instance where when Flea stopped taking drugs in Anthony and Flea and I, the Chili Pepper story, where it's in Anthony's book that Anthony kind of told him that he wasn't like us and he should save himself.
That's what they told you. Is that what they told you?
That's what Anthony says in his book, like the Flea just wasn't as bad like me and Anthony, so it was better that he get out of here and save himself.
Oh,
and then mine was Flea just made up his mind not to do it anymore and moved out. And then Flea's writing a book right now about the same thing. And he said, that's not what happened, either the Anthony thing or your thing.
What and did I was happen? Like, did tell you
he just didn't want to be around us.
And that helped him get sober.
Yeah, that
Shocking.
Was probably more realistic. Yeah.
All three were true.
Yeah, all three were true in a certain. It was obvious that he was not like Anthony and I. We took off like Learjet.
We got to get Tom in here and do it. We're interviewing people we've treated through the television program stuff.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah,
he's doing really well, apparently.
That's what I hear.
And here's the thing about in Tom's book, he says I was his drug dealer or something. I got him, I had drugs and he wanted some. That's different. And of course you're going to pay for it. That's that drug
you
dealing,
were, you
Drew.
Were his oh my God, unofficial.
You're fucking
unofficial.
Splitting hairs, dude. If I were a cop, you're his drug dealer.
It's not the same. It was like drugs I had, and I was at this club, and he wanted some, and I said, okay, I'll sell you half. And then all of a sudden, Tom Sizemore's drug dealer, because he then became one of the all-time great drug addicts, I must be a horrible drug dealer.
There's a crazy phenomenon of, it's only in Los Angeles, of these stories of people having multiple relationship histories in multiply different contexts,
mm-hmm.
because addicts in this town run together.
Oh yeah, yes. We do.
Right, and so they all know each other. They all run together. They've all been involved with each other in some way, and then there's other incarnations as life goes on. Where, like, literally, Bob will go. Like, I'll be working with Bob with a patient for a year or something. He'll go, oh yeah, we used to do. We used to slam drugs at MacArthur Park. I'm like, what the what?
Right.
Or the one that really freaked me out was because that was years of working with Jeff. And Jeff goes, oh, yeah, Jeff.
Yeah, Jeff tried to help me get off of drugs.
I tried the 12-step.
Jeff Conaway.
Yeah. I'm not surprised. It all circles back.
It freaked me
well,
totally out.
Well, here's the intersection. The intersection
Jeff was
that
so
you
sick.
Don't know,
Poor
that
Jeff.
You don't, it's underappreciated, is actors want to be musicians. And musicians want to be actors.
I know.
So they have this love of each other and this kind of cyclical weird thing where I'm just in awe of Tom's acting.
And Tom,
he wants to play guitar in some shitty
band.
He wants to be
Steven Adler. When I saw him talk to Steven Adler about his admiration for his drumming, I thought, oh, that's
isn't that weird?
I had to sit
so there's
and watch
always
videos
that
of
actor,
Tom's
musician
music.
Intersection.
You know, one thing I will say about Tom is he does not let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Yeah, he does not.
So a lot of doing that book was the reason I interviewed you and his old manager.
To try to figure out what's the truth.
What was real, yeah.
Well, to be fair, memory is a terribly inaccurate mechanism.
Yes.
Especially when you're doing drugs. Then it's really messed up.
Especially
if you're
in a how about a hypersense of narcissism, too? When you take
the
100 people that hung out at the Vipe Room every night for 5 years, they're all narcissists. They're all actors and musicians. They're all living their own fantasy worlds of what's going on.
Yeah.
That's where a lot of the intersections are, that club.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where I met Tom.
Yeah, yeah. Meanwhile, I was home doing cocaine alone. I mean, if only I had known.
Well, but you got
to
get
out
to
the club. I don't know if you talk about this at all. Do you talk about that?
Oh, the
boyfriend thing?
Yeah, but that was in college.
I'm just
that was
saying.
Pre, like, crazy.
Can you talk about it?
Yeah, it was in that Kindle single. So, yeah. So I dated Matt Damon before he was famous. And
in Massachusetts or here?
Yeah.
In college.
Yeah, I went to Trinity, which was an hour from Harvard.
Oh,
and
my
I have
God.
A total Harvard
so
fetish
religious.
Because...
No.
I'm a Jew. I'm just, like, a terrible Jew.
No, wait. Trinity in Hartford?
Trinity in Hartford has
not religious
affiliation.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Jerry Falwell.
No.
Definitely not.
One of our kids came very close to going to Trinity. It's great.
Isn't there a Trinity
so
Jerry Falwell
there's
school?
There's all kinds of
there's
Trinity
like
schools.
There's like
70
okay. Trinities.
The Trinity is in Hartford.
Okay.
Yeah, I like that you're calling it the Trinity. Yeah. But I had this very much of like a sort of Harvard fetish, if you will, because everybody in my family went there.
Oh, Jesus.
And
Do you know who Robert Stobau is?
God help you.
The head of the business school there. His son was the guitar player in Thelonious Monster, and he was so not proud.
Is he still?
Yeah.
Is he still there?
No, he's retired a long time ago. But when we first played in Boston,
I need some help for one of my kids.
We went. I wanted to go see where Love Story happened. So assistant like took me to the hockey rink and the baseball, you know, little park.
Well,
thing.
Anna decided to live that out.
Did you live it out?
Yes.
It is a great fantasy.
Wait, which fantasy are we talking about?
Love Story.
Oh, God.
She's too
young. But the girl has to die.
No, I mean, Ryan O'Neal.
She got wasted and drifted off, so to speak.
So I used to go to Harvard every weekend, and, you know, he was just like a random talented guy. The crazy part is I broke his heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Well, I'm going to fuck that one up. one thing, what was I going to say?
Baroque it.
I had something super important to say when you were talking about, Thelonious, John Huck, who I randomly know, didn't know till I saw Bob and the Monster.
Oh, he's the bass player in Thelonious Monster. He was in it with Bill Stobow. That's so crazy.
So weird. You know, that movie was, and I did a story, I interviewed the director.
Oh, she's awesome.
I've interviewed you a couple times over the phone. But it was this intersection, I'm like, you know, and they did that awesome animation when you guys talked back in the day on.
Oh my
Love
God!
Line.
Could
that was
you imagine
so cool.
that? Did you? But that what I cool. what I said to him was
I know,
so bizarre.
So again, like the Alexi thing, like weird.
If you haven't seen the movie, it's called Bob and the Monster. It's great. It's a documentary about Bob's life. But he was on my radio show back in the Using days, Loveline, and they pulled out old footage. And they made a claymation sort of, didn't they?
It was cool,
like,
yeah.
Drawing thing out of it. And in it, I go, Jesus, if you get your shit, because he was giving these very empathic responses to people. I think it was addiction, too, you were dealing with. And I said, man, if you could get your shit together, you could make a good therapist one day.
Right.
And I had no recollection of that, by the
way.
When
so
we came, you know,
that's in there.
Of that event?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
So we were on... I mean, looking at me.
He wanted me to give a lecture to a group of people for his little. He was doing a little sort of expose at my usual lectures, and in the front row was this guy with the hat. And I'm like, in my head, I'm having this head. I'm like,
right.
Oh my God, the guy looks like Bob Forrest.
And but you could see him in the footage thinking that.
And I told everybody, and I thought, isn't that funny? And afterwards, he came up and I said, he goes, we know each other. I go, no. I thought it's well, but this talent, as a treatment professional.
It's codependency and antisocial.
First one, codependent fit together.
It's perfect.
Interesting.
Yeah. Because Bob is an antisocial. He's always like, oh, fuck the man. Fuck it.
Fuck him.
I mean, I'm an antisocial type. Yeah. And I have zero of that, which is weird.
What's your personality?
Yeah, but I should have been the man to him, right?
But what
is
yours? Right. What is your personality?
Oh, I mean, are we doing the...
We should
like,
have people define their personality disorder.
Interesting.
If you have... Yeah, that's a fair thing.
Well, I mean, I think that's smart. I'm happy to indulge.
Well, she already said. She called it.
What did I call already?
You said, well...
Oh, yeah. No, narcissism. I mean, how long do you have? I definitely... Narcissism, but not narcissistic personality disorder, because I'm highly aware of it, and
that's
you can't
right.
be aware of it if you actually have the disorder.
Well, you can't... If you're borderline, you can't be aware of it.
We can't, that too.
Any true personality disorder, you blame the world for everything. You don't take really responsibility for anything. And this is what we call narcissistic traits.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Without a doubt.
So we should do that with every guest. They should have to kind of say generally what's wrong with them.
All right.
Easy.
All right. Let's do Drew now. Drew.
I have narcissistic
your
traits for sure.
You're codependent.
Severe codependency. Mm. And
how do you avoid it with
disorder.
Your
workaholism.
Kids? How do you avoid being your codependent with your kids because you're not with your kids?
I probably am. I probably contain it, and they probably feel it. probably is actually happening. I just try not to do it. But my codependency is a lot better because of therapy and stuff too. It's a lot better.
But it ebbs and flows.
It ebbs and flows. It can overcome.
And you know what I notice with you?
Yeah.
You will come to the defense of the defenseless, like Khloe Kardashian or whatever the fuck the girl's name is.
No, I just said, listen.
That's your codependency defending her.
No, I would disagree.
Chris Kardashian. What's her name?
Khloe.
Khloe. That's almost my antisocial self. because I don't like people. I really have this thing about people being condemned for things they did not do. And when somebody does something right, I don't care who they are, we need to say that's right. We need to say what that is.
I think it can be a shared responsibility. The Kardashians are difficult because they just are representative of people and materialism.
Yes,
we're
watching them. They just create them.
And our empty society that wants to just sort of worship.
So we have tremendous disdain for what they represent. But she, this woman, has had this person that was important in her life have this horrible thing happen.
Yes.
And she has done some things that people were discussing in the press, like stay married, stop the divorce. I said, perfect. He needs a medical decision maker, and it should be his spouse. She's not a she should be making decisions. He's not. He's impaired. He's not going to make decisions. She went out there. There were a couple of things she was doing. I remember,
well, one thing she did, because we wrote about it on the site, was she's going forward with this drink called like Drinks with Chloe, which is like, you know, your husband, your ex-husband, whatever, just had this horrible OD, and you're putting together a reality show about drinking. I'm sure it's not entirely about drinking.
Like skinny, like the skinny.
No, it's
going to
be like In Bed with Joan, right?
Maybe, but like maybe change the title. I don't know if, you know.
I would argue not.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I would argue not, because.
You love her.
No,
he
I don't.
He really does.
No, I don't.
You're defending her.
I'm defending because it warrants
really,
defense.
Here's the thing. I don't really have a problem with her or any of them. Yeah, I do have a problem with the mother.
See, I have a but I have a problem with you guys taking after her just because it's her. My point is, you're judging her harshly because you can't stand this.
I would judge anybody who did that.
I think you're right, but the
what about the society
I would be on a show called Drinks with Fill in the Blank because I think it's dishonest if we don't make a clear distinction between people with a disorder and people with not, and if people want to use intoxicants in their life. Okay, whatever. We can talk about it during the Drinks with Whomever show. The difference, you know what
true,
I mean?
Well, except for
this
one
is a guy
the...
who was on Drunk History, don't forget.
Yeah, which I think is... Now, that gets a little more concerning because you worry that maybe the guy's drinking maybe...
There was one guy who was unconscious.
That people think, I think people think like, oh my God, there's Dr. Drew, I can't... Oh, I got to hide my drink.
And which it's is,
like
that bothers me.
I know. And that's you have insane. No issue with non-alcoholics drinking.
Yeah, he's a real buzzkill.
I know. I'm interested in helping people... stop or curtail or whatever they want to do, who can't stop on their own.
But I will say one thing.
And are having problems as a result. Yeah.
About this drinks, you know, the major misconception that addiction and alcoholism are something different is important also.
Yep,
that,
yep,
you know,
yep.
I know I thought like, oh, I'm just a Coke addict.
Well,
and I like Ambien.
And
I don't need to stop drinking.
Did you ever
you
crush
know?
The Ambien up and put it in the Coke?
No, that
then you're
been
not an addict.
Oh, my God. No. I'll tell you why she is. She looked literally like crestfallen. Like,
I know.
How did
that
I miss
actually sounds
that?
Awful.
Really...
That doesn't sound good.
No,
I don't want an upper
good,
and a downer
good,
at the same
good.
Time. Okay. I mean, I'll have to trust you because I don't plan on ever trying it.
I didn't know it was, they used to sell these things called diazepam for a dollar a pill.
That's value.
I take like 10 of them, crush them up, and then put them in Coke. And somehow you felt like you were on heroin for like, about 10 minutes.
I was just reading this thing that they're using Ativan. They're using Ativan to get people off of like alcohol drugs. I'm just like, I was so addicted to Ativan.
No, you can use Ativan for a few days, but it's Ativan has a weird effect. Is that even when it's appropriately used in addicts, it increases their sense of desperation.
Ooh.
That's what I noticed. So I stopped using it altogether in any kind of detox situation, unless seizures sometimes. But
you give them a benzo they don't like called Librium. It's a benzo.
Yeah, go ahead. But Fred wants to pop in here. Let's get Fred.
Yeah, he's got some Ativan ideas.
What's the difference Ativan and Xanax?
Xanax is a more shorter acting, more fun, more euphorogenic, has a little more antidepressant
property. Which one's more euphoric?
Xanax, and a little faster acting, and tighter binding, and shorter acting.
Why is Librium not a pleasant experience?
It's a different chemical, has a different effect in different regions of the brain. It's all GABAergic, and you know, GABA is sort of a modulator. In some areas, it hits tighter and can increase mood and increase euphoria. In others, not.
When you say these bad for depression, pot and Ativan, is it because messing with someone who's on Lexapro, SSR, what are they called?
SSRIs.
Yeah, is it... Why are these things bad for depression, either pot or Ativan and Xanax?
Well, Ativan is addictive. And eventually you start getting more anxiety with it. You start getting this sort of...
It makes you want one.
You sort of get into chronic withdrawal, and the withdrawal from Ativan is miserable. And so it kind of adds to your misery and adds to lability and stuff. And it may have some direct... There's been concern about these medicines actually causing dementia.
So many people listening right now are going, oh my God, I take Ativan every day.
Yeah, but you can take
they
it for a while. It's a safe...
I don't feel like it's that popular a drug.
Not right
my
now.
Drug using
yeah,
days.
Because
Klonopin seems to
Klonopin
be popular.
Seems to be... But I would use Ambien and Ativan sort of interchangeably.
Yeah, it's a little sleep-inducing. It's good sleep-inducing.
Did you read... There's this study out that that Lexapro, or I don't know if you're on Lexapro, that it can stave dementia.
Stave it off. Yeah.
Just Lexapro, not the other SSRIs.
Right. So again, there's let's a little.
All it also affects your libido.
Well, yeah.
Lexapro, less so.
I can't tell if it's Lexapro or middle age.
Or the depression.
You know, I got into antidepressants at a good time, yeah. Where it's well, supposed to be that anyway.
Let's ask a doctor. Yeah. What's the number one thing that people ask you when you put them on an SSRI? They go, this isn't going to affect that, is it?
No, they used to never. That's why I went on that campaign to try to raise awareness about that. And that's where I got shit on, because the who funded that campaign was a drug company.
Well, when you're in a severe chemical depression.
And the only reason I got, you understand, the only reason I had got any shit about it, people didn't understand what the issue was.
Right.
Is because in a radio interview, I was just saying, these medicines cause this side effect.
Yeah.
And the guy goes, well, what do you do? And I go, well, in my practice, what do? I switch to Remeron, Wellbutrin, or Cerazone.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll add Wellbutrin in, but that's what I do in my practice. And I forgot to say, oh, by the way, I'm getting funded in this thing.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
And so that was the whole issue.
Yeah.
One radio interview in a campaign that I did for 2 years. I'm running around the country like a madman doing something I thought was I was very proud of that campaign. And
because you because it didn't affect your libido, that drug?
That one didn't. And do you know anyone?
And Wellbutrin can undo.
A libido is a nice way of saying.
Well, I was going to say, do you know anyone?
Erectile dysfunction.
With a severe chemical depression and has a big libido sex drive?
Already.
Yeah, they don't.
If no, they don't.
A big,
right.
Severe chemical that's right. depression. See, so what are they afraid of? It could only get better.
Well, I'll tell you, I was on Effexor for 15 years.
Yeah.
And getting off of it,
terrible.
It was. No, well, it wasn't that bad. I did a taper.
Oh, you got lucky.
But also, I mean, I felt like a 16-year-old boy after I got off of it because my sex drive had been so tampered down.
Did it stay that way to stay up?
Kind of stayed up.
Yeah. So that's just you. That's good.
Yeah. So,
but when you're in a big depression, though, you don't have a good sex drive. Right?
Exactly. So, when I would try to go off of them, I'd get so depressed I wouldn't want to have sex. So I'm like, well, why not just be on them? And not have a sex
and
drive.
Semi
yeah,
to.
Why not be healthier?
And not have
Yeah, so it's, I think, once it first, I was put on something called Pamelar for.
Oh, wow, it's an old one.
That was an old one. I had a, not for depression, but I had a, got assaulted and have ligament damage in my face.
Mm. Oh, my God.
And this guy, it was the worst place.
Did you not know that, Drew?
No, I didn't know.
How bad was the head trauma?
I got assaulted in New York.
Did you have depression before the assault?
I think all my life,
I've
had a lot of stuff.
But it got more severe after the head trauma.
Well, a lot of issues because, nerves was damaged in my face. And then I got TMJ. You know how when you have a knee, it's either through arthritis, either through football players get it through an injury or you get it through, what's it
called?
Aging. Mine was ligament damage through an assault on my face, you know. And so then I had this TMJ that they couldn't treat, and it fucked me up because all my life I've not had my feelings validated, and my girlfriends and, it's in your head. Well, it is in my head. Yeah. But, they think you just will it away. So I'd go to these physical therapists that were very incompassionate. This is like a funny story where I went to this UCLA place. And this very impatient nurse going, I see thousands of people. Why can't you do the exercise? So I was so afraid I went to another physical therapist to get coached for this one. But so part of the treatment was they were very cold at this place in UCLA. And they put me on Pamelar for the serotonin.
Yeah.
And I've never gained weight from Lexapro. But this one ballooned up, dry mouth.
Yeah.
And it really
could cause sterilization, vomiting, death.
No, that's
the only thing. But at the end of every drug commercial, there's always like all those things, and we're just like, I won't be sad anymore.
I'll feel better.
But I was on it for not depression, but for the injury. What could you tell me about Pamelar?
All medicines are dangerous. They're dangerous. Pamelor is the old, you guys remember this term? Tricyclic antidepressants.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Remember that? That's I should have been treated with that when I was in college with my panic attacks. I'm pissed to this day that they didn't offer me that. They fucked me up. But it was a very powerful, good. It's caused a little drowsiness. It caused a lot of dry mouth.
Like Seroquel?
Why did
or
I gain weight on that?
Some of those side effects.
I've never gained weight on
it. Yeah, well, the tricyclic, any of these can make you gain weight.
Let me tell the gaining weight.
Would not be bad for me.
Let me tell you a side note, very funny story with Dr. Drew.
Uh-oh.
So there's a client who he put on, I think, Depakote or whatever.
I put on? Okay.
Yeah, and she's gaining weight. Mm-hmm. And she's very conscious of weight. Mm-hmm. So then Drew is getting frustrated with her because she is also a very personality troubled person, uh-huh. right?
I almost and feel like he, I know who this is.
You
go
know
on.
Who it is.
Okay,
she
go
was
on.
Actually on a TV show with us.
Uh-oh. So who I maybe got
sober
with?
So, probably.
Back
so,
in the day?
So she's telling me, get him to understand, Bob. Get him to understand. I go, dude, really, literally, it's, she's going to use again if she gains any more weight. So we need to take this serious. And then you saw her and you were, you know, like you got it, but I guess you had said, like, what would you rather be, like suicidally depressed and on coke, or like have 10 pounds overweight? And to her, she'd rather be suicidally depressed and on coke.
I don't think I would say, unless I was really busy that day, I don't think I would say
no. Now
like
think
that.
Of who it was.
Come on,
I have
Drew.
No fucking idea. But
you need some Lexapro so that your memory is better.
I don't think about people in those kinds of categories.
Right.
I mean,
it was the personality problems were so predominant.
Well documented personality problems in the media.
And it was at Lost in Sands Retreat this morning?
Yes.
Okay.
Anyways, but the point being that these people like us are so crazy. They'd rather be high than over 10 pounds overweight.
Of course. But listen,
and
I
think you're always sensitive to it, but when somebody's batshit crazy and it's keeping them from being batshit crazy, you can't understand why they would want to be that way.
Yeah.
Well, the whole concept of people not taking their meds is so strange to me. You know, you always hear that. I mean, especially about people who kill themselves. Oh, well, he stopped taking his meds. Like,
why?
Meds have just... helped my life so incredibly much. I would occasionally with Effexor, I would forget sometimes and be like dope sick. That withdrawal.
Terrible.
Well, I think they do it bipolar because you have a bad bipolar,
better.
Then you
like the high.
Yeah.
Do you like the high or you? They feel they're not as creative when they feel they're this middle thing.
Yes, they don't like that.
And they like the manic of the high.
That's exactly right.
I mean, the guy David Strickland I work with from Suddenly Susan, he was the one that...
Oh, yeah. He died in
with
Vegas.
Andy Dick in Vegas, and he stopped taking the medicine and sadly hung himself.
Yeah,
but a lot of those...
By the way, bipolars are more likely to kill themselves manic than depressed.
Oh.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
Why is that interesting.
No one really knows. They just get these... They get... You know, it's just like somebody at LSD jumping out of a window. They get very impulsive, and
I think... when people, they don't realize the medicine's working. They go, I don't need this. And they stop. They go, I'm good. Is that why they stop taking
it? Well, it's like sobriety, too. People feel better.
Right. Yes. I'm like, normal. Oh. I don't need this. But you asked about way back about pot and depressant effects. Just exactly the way you experience it, it can work short term, but it depletes, it downregulates certain regions of the brain that are associated with affect improvement. And by the way, there's been a lot of show about depression today. There are magnetic treatments now for depression too. Dr. Hutton's doing that.
Is that that's real?
Oh, it's fantastic.
What is that?
It's without medication. They can blast magnets in.
Get out of here. Yeah. So it's like a outpatient shock treatment or
Yes. It's the same idea, but it's using magnets, not electricity.
Does it affect your memory the way shock
There's some little side effects like that, but not nearly as profound as
I had a thing about depression, by the way. What do you think of this theory? I like asking three men this. That men are better able to tolerate depression, whereas for women, it's like I'm jumping out of my skin.
Now, yes or no, because two things. First of all, there's a study that middle-aged men are killing themselves at an alarming rate.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think, oh, we hit 50 or this, and all the stigma is supposed to own property, supposed to have this. I don't know. There's a lot of middle-aged men. And what you said, I think maybe women, because of PMS, are more used to their emotions.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's right. Just our hormones.
Yeah, you're more
so.
Used to it.
Yeah.
You've had it your whole life. So maybe,
and yet I think you're onto something. I don't disagree with that. I wouldn't say PMS, but they're more emotionally
aware.
Yeah,
and I do think that's what it is. I mean, I don't know the statistics about women killing themselves versus men killing themselves, but I do think this constant awareness can be very uncomfortable in your day to day life. But ultimately,
but the other thing I've noticed, women in mood, they tend to just the way borderlines use projective identification. Women in emotional stress. Push it out onto other people.
Yes.
They not even act it out. It's kind of a pushing it out.
Yes.
Like, you need to experience what I'm feeling. I'm not happy till you're feeling this. Like
I thought
do.
That was just me.
Well, they project like someone I know.
It's called projective identification.
I won't say who.
It's projective identification.
But she keeps putting her shit on me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Fred, you always dwell on things, and it's her thing.
Stop talking about Kathy Griffin like that. No, it's not Kathy anymore. Kathy punched punched?
No, she has to punch me. Oh, she asked nicely.
Okay.
Well, that's nice.
After sex.
After sex.
She, what happened? Oh, yeah, yeah. She said she just saw a TV movie about women that abuse men physically, and she wanted to do it. I said, no, I have TMJ. I can't get punched. It would aggravate it. She goes, I have hostility towards men. I said, why? She goes, they rape, they go to strip clubs, and they see porno. And I said, kidding around, I only do two out of those three. But she at least asked me. She wanted
Can
to hit
I punch
me,
you in the face. She wanted to punch
unfair,
you in the face.
It's unfair to bring. Let's stop because I love Kathy. It's
no, I love her too. Yeah. I just tell that story. It was a salacious chapter in my book. But she's cool. So she's really.
Why didn't she just punch you in the stomach?
She should have asked. Yeah, no. Stomach. Yeah, no one,
not
no
as
one punches people in the stomach sexually.
Ask, it's, this That's is back to question. Women in depression. Anna,
yes.
Explain. Why
she's
the face?
Honest, yeah.
You know, I am for all, like I have been, I've never hit anybody and I'm not saying I deserve a medal for that, but I am surprised how many women I know who are like, oh, weren't you like pulling hair and like shoving your friends? Like that was never, mine has always been more, if I was going to be abusive, it was going to be emotional and verbal.
Oh,
it was never going to be physical.
That's the worst. I have a fear of any women,
deeper and,
even if
and
I'm
oh,
yeah.
more horrifying.
Way more horrifying.
I have a fear of women, even if they're not dating them, being mad at me. I don't want people mad. Like anytime I don't get a text return, they're mad. I said something.
But that's so codependence,
women,
right?
Yes.
If we're diagnosing everybody.
Yes, I don't like. I want to please people. Yes, and but
let's
yeah.
Let's get to why middle-aged men are killing themselves. Because I have a theory.
Go ahead. Okay. I think it's hopelessness.
It's
I don't
well,
think men,
I think
middle-aged men are not given much hope.
I just recently went through this. I have a little bit of experience. I am a middle-aged man, and I have depression. So.
Okay.
When a divorce, when a family is going to end being a family, mm-hmm. it's always the man, even though we're all equal and everything's equal and equal this and equal that. It's always that the man has to leave his home, leave where his children live,
right.
and live in an apartment by themselves.
Right.
And I would wonder how many of those men, because it got deep this year, the depression.
I could see that.
And you're just, you know, at first you get all excited, like, I got my own bed. You know what I mean? I can do whatever I want.
Free at last.
Yeah. Like,
but then there's a deep, deep depression. I think a lot of men in America are going through that, and it's politically incorrect to say, why do the men have to leave?
Right.
Why, you know.
I'm
Well, you're going to have an opinion. That's,
well, I'm just, what do we accomplish by transferring that mood problem onto the women, number one? And then number two, I'm not sure it would abort the mood problem if you just stayed in the same house that was empty.
But it could. I think that there's something to that.
I'm just mostly talking about social norms that we say we're an equal society, but always, 9 times out of 10, the man leaves the
home. Well, but we say we're an equal society and women are getting screwed over constantly. I mean, it's not remotely true.
I'm in disagreement with that right now because I'm living like a hobo while my wife lives in a very nice house.
Well, the one thing, because I have a lot of friends and my brother and stuff like that who are going through these divorces, and the laws in California, if you have a kid,
unbelievable.
What can happen to
you? Haven't
men,
seen my you haven't seen my documentary Divorce Corp? Please watch.
Really? You have?
Oh,
that?
Oh yes, I did it with
what's
I
happening to your brother?
It.
I want to hear.
But
it just happened to me.
It was
no,
a project
but I know
that was
a lot of.
It was a project I was delighted to get behind. I was the voice for it, but it was well done. And it is about how particularly the child care stuff, they just rape you for the analysis and the fighting over the kids and then what
so,
you end up having
well,
to pay.
Well, we started fighting and then in the end I just said, you know what, I don't want my son's life to change in any way. Okay, let's do it and I'll figure it out. But that all be well being said, that's the right thing to do and keep everything as steady as possible. The toll it takes on men living by themselves and starting over at 50 years old is unbelievable.
I'm not surprised.
Well, and I do think, and I realize this is I have all sorts of sort of anti-feministic things I will say, but I am horrified because basically what I've been learning is that the man basically cannot go, if there's still a kid under 18, the man cannot go and like buy a big amazing house without having to buy a big amazing house for the ex so that child...
lives
you know,
in a like environment.
I mean, and whatever. And a lot of the women aren't working at all.
So, anyways,
you know.
I just thought that might be an interesting note of what's going on across America because divorce is out of control.
But I have a theory.
Yeah,
to, like men, because their whole lives are more arrested development in that they you know, women their whole life, it's about, and they're preparing themselves for not being all attractive as they get older.
Right.
Men could kind of, you know, still be, think they're like a 30-year-old when they're 45, 50 trying to date.
Yeah.
And they're not as stigmatized as being older. But then when they really, let's say, get to be about 60 or whatever, or late 50s, you know what I'm saying? It just blows them away because they're not prepared. You know what I mean?
Okay, I think that's interesting, too. As somebody, I do look young for my age. Right.
Men fall off a cliff, you mean?
Right. Yeah. Women are preparing for that cliff. Well, they think they're old when they're 32, and they're not. Guys, well, like me, for example, I'm more delusional. Not that I'm going to get a hot chick, but you know what I'm saying? But I'm saying that all of a sudden, oh, my God, I'm really old, and we're not as prepared for being old. You know what I'm saying? Where women are prepared.
Okay.
Younger,
well, okay.
And they're more in reality that way.
So I come from this family where everybody just genetically looks really, really young. My mother is 76 and looks like 50. And
nice.
And so for my whole
it's Italian.
No, we're Jewish. Russian Jews, you
Russian
know.
Jews.
With
my
like
father's
olive
from
skin.
Russian.
Usually
Jewish.
Those look 80 when they're 40.
Yeah.
I think the
are you sure
age
about
faster.
That? Because there's a lot of lies going generation after generation.
By the way, I have no idea. There's like, oh, I did 23andMe. You know that thing where you spit in a cup and you find out really
oh,
what
yeah.
you are?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, and I've got very little, but some Native American.
Whoa.
Who knew?
Whoa, who knew?
And I'm 2.6 Neanderthal.
Nice.
Yep.
Wow.
That
yep.
explains a lot.
Does it not? Does it not? But one thing I was going to say to Fred's point is because I've looked younger than I am.
How is that even possible?
That I've 2.6 Neanderthal?
Neanderthals we're co-creating with
the... I have the same...
Holy you better check
moly,
yours, Bob.
I have the same thing. I've always looked younger, so then I'm used to looking younger. Then now I start to look my age, and it, you know, we're not used to it.
Yeah, when people actually say, like, when how old are you? And I tell them, and they're not surprised. I'm like,
because you're used to always being the baby.
But know? But I do think, you know, sort of I confuse looking young with being young for a long time.
Yes.
And it's sort of hitting me that I'm the age that I am.
Yeah.
But let's get back to the white man. Let's get back
Sorry.
To us.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, because it's an important topic, and I don't think anyone's really addressing it. I think men feel so disempowered on every front. There's nowhere for a white
no
man
No more so than in mediation, Drew.
Well, everywhere. Everywhere where it counts. The male, particularly the white male, is completely without any resource, without any advocate.
Nobody's advocating for drug addicts and nobody's advocating for
men. We have all kinds of privilege and all that stuff. I get that. But when it comes to empowerment,
how about empathy towards men and their issues?
It's interesting.
Men are killing themselves at the highest rate in America in history.
It's a hopelessness.
And nobody could give a fuck.
Yeah. You know,
well, is it because you're supposed to own property and that's what I judge myself?
I never
owned a house. I never had a family. I'm a
but
man.
But that's not preventing anybody from being depressed, what you have.
Right.
You know, we just ran a story on After Party. This is interesting. This week where one of my writers said something like, blah, blah, blah. And the audience was made up of a bunch of white middle class men or middle aged men.
Yeah.
And we got all these comments from men who were offended that she wrote that. And
what did she write?
All she wrote was like, the audience was made up of a bunch of
mostly
white middle-aged men.
That's
and,
offensive?
And that was offensive, and it kind of speaks to what you're saying. That like,
was it a U2 concert? No, I'm just kidding.
You're not allowed. Like, you're allowed. It was so interesting to me that there was this knee-jerk response to sort of this group that is
because
considered the most
privileged.
Because
I think men are getting angry, finally.
I think they are.
But there's a hopelessness. There's a real hopelessness that's setting in because there's no dynamism. There's nothing to empower. There's nothing to say it's good. You keep working hard. It's going to get better.
But how are women more empowered than men?
Certainly the rhetoric is, you know, I get behind it 100%. I mean.
But I mean, how real is that? You know, when we were talking about the sort of equality, it's real in divorce.
Let me tell you my opinion about it. There's in this society, there is not equality. There is just the rich and the rest of us.
Right.
And the rest of us need to stop fighting amongst ourselves.
Right.
And that's where political correctness is. That's where all this class warfare, this racism comes from. There's, you know, 90% of the people in this country are basically three months away from being homeless.
Right.
You know?
And that's
whether you're making $150,000 a year or whether you're making $36,000 a year.
Well, if you
and that's the truth of it. Yeah. And economic, I just know I grew up, my mom was a stay-at-home mom. My dad wasn't a particularly huge breadwinner, but we had two homes. We went on vacations. That can't happen in America anymore.
Right. That's
and
it.
Everybody
right.
needs to ask that's themselves why.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders for president.
But I'm telling you, I don't think the government's going to solve it. I don't have no faith the government is where
right.
the solution is.
Yeah, I don't think it's possible.
But anyway.
Anyways.
We got to wrap this up. This
don't kill yourself. White middle class men, don't kill yourself.
Go get on antidepressants you guys, and just deal with the sexual dysfunction.
This was freewheeling, everybody. Everybody give their plugs. Anna, plugs.
Oh, check out After Party Magazine, the website that I created and I edit. And there's a podcast called After Party Pod, which you are on, Drew.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a wonderful episode. And I have books. Go get Party Girl. Drew says it's the best book about addiction.
How about the Sizemore book? Do you promote that too?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't get any money from that. Not that I get money from any of them, let's be honest, but being an author is like. But I did write Sizemore's book, By Some Miracle, I Made It Out of There, which was one of his lines from Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah. That's his life. That's Tom's life. Fred?
So plug what we make money from?
Anything you want.
No, just kidding. Well, my book, my Seinfeld Year Kindle single, or maybe we'll have you back, my books, and just that, I guess.
Right. Guys, really, it was fun. I appreciate it, Bob. Anything?
Peace out. I'll be at Starbucks.
Hey, and a reminder, everybody, you can check out thislifepodcast.com. You can find the podcast there as well as at podbayfm.com. And a reminder still that this is a Playroom Pods production.
I think they should message it and not say what it is. And the person has to click on it and they'll go, oh my God, what is this?
All right. However, do you tell a friend? We certainly advocate that.
It's on your iPhone. I'll show you. You just push, share feature. There you go.
Share feature. Fine. But
and send it to a bunch of your friends.
Subscribe on iTunes.
Subscribe on iTunes and just do tell a friend because that's how this thing's going to get off the ground. And also, if you want to support it, please go to drdrew.com and click through on the Amazon banner. That helps us out too. Doesn't cost you a thing. But keeps a little wind in the sails here. And we really do appreciate your support.
Well, hell, oh, hell, and cocaine, I love them both, yeah.